Our mission is to bring you an unbiased discussion on the technological development and application of unmanned aerial systems in our airspace. UAS Today.
Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to UAS Today. Some news programs are trying to influence your opinion. I'm just trying to get you informed. Our mission is to look at tomorrow's technology today, see where it's going, and take you along for the journey. Check us out at uas-today.com and send me your questions at michael.garrity@uas-today.com. You can also tweet us at uas-today.
The FAA is going to have to do something with these regulations, and they're going to have to do it fast. As many of you know who've been following the recent upswing in media coverage on unmanned aerial systems, and if you haven't, you need to start. Companies, research groups, and hobbyists are starting to use them in our national airspace. Let me give you some examples. Case 1, Lake Mead Brewery. Back in February, Lake Mead Brewery, which is based in Minnesota, was testing the possibility of delivering beer to ice fishermen on the lake. Now, I know the one thing that ice fishermen needs is beer. However, the FAA was still quick to shut it down. Case in point 2, defining what a UAS is. In 2011, Ralph Picker was given a $10,000 fine for using a UAS aircraft to film a commercial at a university in Virginia. In that case, Picker argued that the case should be thrown out because the FAA regulations did not apply to what essentially was a model aircraft, and in that case, the judge agreed. Case 3, Search and Rescue. Earlier this year, the FAA sent a cease and desist order to the Texas-based company Equisearch. Equisearch is a volunteer nonprofit organization that uses unmanned aerial systems to find lost and missing people since 2007. A federal appeals court ruled back in July that the warning that Equisearch had received had no legal consequences. Now, with the 2015 deadline quickly approaching, the FAA is under the gun to release these regulations on where and how companies, research groups, and hobbyists will be allowed to pilot their small unmanned aerial systems. However, there is a looming question that remains, and I think will remain, even after these regulations come out. The question is, will these regulations matter, and will they be effective? I think the answer to that question is yes. However, I think the answer is going to be years after the regulations are released, law enforcement enforces them, and we have laws that back these regulations up. Let me explain what I'm talking about. Many of my history buffs know, after the First World War, the military had a surplus of the Curtiss JN-4 airplane, also known as Jennies. And no, that's not a Forrest Gump reference. The Jenny was a training aircraft that was developed by the Curtiss Aeroplane and Motor Company. And I want my listeners to remember that name because we're going to be talking about them in the future. The military had a surplus of these planes that they decided to get rid of. They decided to sell these planes at rock-bottom prices because they didn't want them anymore. World War I pilots that had used them during the war purchased them and started using them for stunts and shows. These stunts and shows became known as barnstorming. Now, barnstorming became a real phenomenon in the 1920s. However, by the late 1920s, the competitions became more dangerous, and the stunts often resulted in highly publicized accidents and pilots' deaths. These accidents resulted in the demise of barnstorming. Similarly, I see the UAS industry being regulated in much the same way. We're going to see pilots, we're going to see companies, we're going to see research groups, and we're going to see hobbyists using these unmanned aerial systems in our national airspace. The media will continue to cover them, and any time we see negative attention brought to unmanned aerial systems, the media will capitalize on it. In much the same way, regulations will then be released, which controls the use of these unmanned aerial systems. But remember, Congress only asked the FAA to propose rules and regulations by 2015, and implementing these regulations could take more time. Now, until that happens, we're going to see a lot of businesses testing the waters and trying to figure out a successful business plan for using unmanned aerial systems in our commercial airspace. We're also going to see businesses trying to design successful business models that will work with these regulations once they come out. Now, for my entrepreneurs out there, I want you to pay attention to this podcast for two reasons. First, today on the podcast, we're going to be looking at two companies. The first company, Amazon, has a proposed business model that effectively uses unmanned aerial systems in our national airspace. We'll also be looking at an international company that is delivering pizzas using unmanned aerial systems and has been doing so successfully. Second, today on the podcast, I'll be speaking with an industry leader who is currently helping small businesses get started with using unmanned aerial systems in the national airspace. Let's get started talking about our first company, Amazon. We know that Amazon has been in everyone's radar since back in December of 2013 when Jeff Bezos announced on 60 Minutes that Amazon planned to use unmanned aerial systems to deliver packages to people. It definitely got the media buzzing. It also got entrepreneurs to take a hard look at their business plan and whether or not it would be successful in our national airspace. So what was Amazon's business model? Amazon's idea is to deliver packages to its customers as quickly as possible. They proposed using small unmanned aerial systems to deliver these packages to businesses and homes from medium to large size distribution centers. The idea being that after an order had been placed, once the package reached a distribution center in a small or large city, it would run down the conveyor belt to an awaiting octocopter. That octocopter would be waiting with pre-programmed GPS coordinates to a business or to a home. The octocopter would fly to the business or home, drop off the container, and then fly back to the distribution center. From there, one of two things would happen. Either an Amazon representative would come and pick up the container that the item was shipped in or dropped off by the unmanned aerial system, or you could return it in the mail. Now, as good as that idea sounds, the question is, will that business model work? This wouldn't be the first time that Amazon has proposed a new business idea that didn't work. The answer to that question is maybe. What will make Amazon successful is the same thing that will make businesses that are currently using unmanned aerial systems in other countries that already have a base here in America successful, and that is the business model. Let's take a look at our next company that already has a successful business model that is using unmanned aerial systems, Domino's Pizza. Domino's is the second largest pizza chain in the United States, second only to Pizza Hut, and it is the largest pizza delivery chain with more than 10,000 corporate and franchise stores. Domino's has been delivering pizzas by unmanned aerial systems in the United Kingdom, which means that they already have a successful business model. And, as I've always said, it is the companies who are currently working with unmanned aerial systems that have a proven successful business model that will be successful in the United States once the FAA releases those regulations. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be interviewing an industry leader who is helping small companies get started with unmanned aerial systems in the national airspace. All right, welcome back, folks. Now we're going to get on to our first interview. And I have with me, as I said at the beginning, a leader in the industry who is trying to help small companies really get off in the UAS market. I have Christina Ng. Christina Ng is an Army Reserve Black Hawk pilot in command and brigade UAS advisor. She has over 20 years of multi-service military experience with deployments to Iraq, Afghanistan, and the southern U.S. border. During her time in Afghanistan, she helped rewrite the Aircrew Procedures Guide for unmanned aircraft, ensuring the safe integration of manned and unmanned aircraft in a combat environment. Christina was a former FAA contractor in the AFS-80 UAS Integration Office, where she provided support in the definition of management
and implementation of the changes required to evolve UAS. She provided recommendations regarding programs that could advance the safe and efficient integration of unmanned aerial systems into the national airspace. Her business partner, Kelly Neubecker, is an attorney at law and a retired Navy air traffic controller. This is amazing. The background that you guys have here is fantastic.
That's kind of our strength, to be honest. And really it is. That is where we set ourselves apart from other consultants and other companies in this business. When you look at her strengths and my strengths and the fact that we've both worked at the FAA, and I just left the FAA UAS integration office and have those contacts, that is really important, especially to small businesses.
I would agree with that. So she was involved with the aviation community for over 30 years and is a former FAA headquarters employee. That's amazing. She's an airspace specialist with an airspace regulations and air traffic control procedures group. She developed the regulations. How is the FAA not have you on their payroll right now writing the regulations for this? Can we get them on the phone? Maybe they don't know that you really exist. This is amazing. Okay, where was I?
Okay, that's Kelly.
Group. She developed regulatory language within the Title 49 of the United States Code and Policies for the planning and utilization of navigable airspace, including proposed changes in airspace allocation and air traffic regulations. What does that mean?
That means that she's a lawyer and I'm a pilot.
That's perfect. I love it.
And All right. Like I said, that is why we are such a great team.
Mm-hmm. And then it also says in here that she provides subject matter expertise on the original FAA small UAS rule and served on numerous airspace class SMS panels.
Absolutely. So what some people don't understand is that the small rule started out many years ago, and it has undergone quite a few changes. She sat on the original small UAS panel before it was handed off to the current author.
All right. Well, first and foremost, Christine, thank you very much for being on the show with me today. I'm very excited to have you on here. Let's talk a little bit about your company. Now, your company, UAS Solutions Group, is a female disabled veterans-owned small business. You provide affordable innovation solutions to safe and efficient UAS integration. You also state that UAS Solutions Group has selected a highly specialized team with a thorough understanding of FAA regulatory and policy changes. And I can already tell, and I know my audience is going to know this after 5 minutes of talking with you when we get to the questions, you and your business partner have a wealth of knowledge that I think is going to be very beneficial to our listeners. So I'd really like to get started with the questions if you're ready.
Absolutely.
Okay. So as I said before, your company specializes in helping small businesses that are looking to get started in the unmanned aerial system market. What are some of the services that your company offers to small businesses?
Well, first of all, we would like to say that we're super excited to be here today. So UA Solutions Group, we want to thank Mr. Michael Garrity and his super amazing team here at UAS today for inviting us to participate in their very first podcast. We would like to thank you very much for that. Any of your listeners can access our website at uasolutionsgroup.com and see a very general list of our services. They range in everything from FAA interface to regulatory and technical support. We have Section 333 of the FAA Modernization and Reform Act exemptions, certificates of waiver and authorization processing, airspace use analysis, proposed preparation support, UAS training curriculum development, and I'm like, wait a minute. So let's make this user-friendly. To an emerging company unfamiliar with unmanned aircraft and aviation, it's a very sterile list on our website. For a small company unfamiliar with this landscape, our company really wants to reach out to them through this regulatory process, and we want to ensure that we maintain a safe national airspace and ultimately provide success for their company. One aspect that is very unique to our company is our FAA connections, because as we stated before, we're both former employees.
Right.
So because of our proximity to DC and the connections we have in the emerging UAS community, we're able to provide small businesses access to industry experts and mentors that would help guide them down this road of unmanned aircraft regulations. And these mentors and leaders in this community would otherwise not be accessible by small businesses,
right,
simply because they're not in the industry already. That is a key component to where we move forward with small businesses. One of the things that is very daunting, it is very daunting for a small business when you look at all of the rules and regulations and policies that the FAA has in place and that state, local, and federal governments have in place. It's very daunting. So we want to make sure that that is accessible to everyone. And what's amazing when we work with the new companies, it provides us an insight that a new UAS company needs in order for them to stand up and operate. Those of us who are manned aviators and have been in the manned aviation world for a couple of years, have a preconceived notion of what flying in the national airspace should look like. When you work with small companies, they don't have those preconceived notions. And it's amazing to be able to step back and look at it from a new operator and from the unmanned aircraft operator's point of view, and not just from a manned aircraft operator's point of view.
Absolutely. I think one of the, touching on that part that you're saying with the misconceptions, is you have essentially your hobbyists who are flying these model aircrafts, and you have pilots who are piloting very large aircrafts. And I think that, at least from my perspective on it, is that both sides are kind of unclear about what the other does and how to operate, especially in our airspace. A lot of people, hobbyists, are like, well, we've been flying these for years. We're flying them at 400 feet. What does anybody care? And pilots are saying, no, there's a really bad potential here for what could go wrong if people are not made aware of it. This is really great what your company's doing. Tell me more.
So I want to interject with a really good example on the point about manned pilots versus unmanned pilots, not understanding the two. So while I was in Afghanistan, one of the things that the unit I fell in with there did not have was a crew rest procedure. So for manned aviation, we have historical data from years and years of research, and we understand exactly pretty much when pilots really get tired, when we get exhausted, and when under a combat environment, it's easier for us to get exhausted even sooner. Under night vision goggles, you know, we get exhausted even sooner. And when I fell in on this unit in Afghanistan, and they didn't have crew rest policy, I didn't make them adhere to the manned aviation crew rest policy. And I told my soldiers, I said, I do not know when you're tired. I don't understand that because I've never looked at a screen I don't know when you're tired because I've never looked at a computer screen for 4 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours. You being new to this community as a whole, you have to figure this out. You have to tell us, when are you tired? When are you not tired? Are you okay to fly? Are you not okay to fly? And as we start gathering that historical data, then together, even here with the FAA stateside, we can start coming up with rules, regulations, and policy for even the most of simple ideas as crew rest.
You bring up an interesting point. As you know, as I know, and as some of my listeners know, the FAA has recently established test sites throughout the United States. Do you think this could be potentially something that they'll be looking for research-wise?
So right now, the test sites aren't determining what needs to be done necessarily at the test sites. They're waiting on people like you and me and other companies to go to them, to the test sites, and say, this is what we would like to test, and these are the parameters on which we would like to test this. Do you have a test site that would fit my needs? I'm a small unmanned aircraft, or I'm a large unmanned aircraft. So for this situation, if you wanted to go and conduct crew rest management, then absolutely the test sites should be there for you to go and run your tests if that's what your studies are going to be based upon, and that's what you want to learn, and that's what you want to contribute to this overall unmanned aircraft unknown world of regulations and policy.
What can you tell us about Section 333 of the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012?
So in 2012, Congress passed the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012, known as the FMRA. So Section 333 provided a way for the FAA to move forward with incremental UAS integration under certain rules, and they were for specific, limited, low-risk civil operations. It's sort of the bridge between extremely limited national airspace access and the release of the small UAS rule. The FAA administrator, Mr. Huerta, he has identified these Section 333 exemptions as a priority. In order for us to understand Section 333, we have to understand what it says. Section 333, or Special Rules for Certain Unmanned Aircraft Systems, It grants the FAA limited statutory flexibility to expedite requirements for safe and operation of certain aircraft systems in the NAS. So the interim policy basically provides a framework for authorizing safe civil operations in the national airspace prior to the small UAS rule. Like we said before, it's a bridge. Specifically, the Section 333 authorizes the FAA to determine if certain unmanned aircraft systems, if any, as a result of their size, weight, speed, operational capability, proximity to airports and populated areas, and operation within visual line of sight, do not create a hazard to users of the national airspace system or the public or pose a threat to national security. And whether a certificate of waiver, certificate of authorization, or airworthiness certification under Section 44704 of Title 49 United States Code is required for the operation of unmanned aircraft systems identified under page one. So it's really boring, right? Absolutely. It's very boring. So that's
why I'm listening to what you're saying and I'm like, What?
So the FAA says you can view the exemption request at regulations.gov.
Okay.
But you can. So anybody can go to regulations.gov and do a query search for the exemptions that the FAA have on the docket right now. So in order, when you request an exemption, it goes onto the docket. It sits there for 20 days for comment. Anybody who's curious what an exemption looks like and what is happening, it can go to regulations.gov and look at these exemptions. It is a way for the FAA to slowly allow access to the national airspace under very rigid conditions, under very safe conditions, to start the slow integration of unmanned aircraft between the time that there was no national airspace access for commercial use to the implementation of the small rule. So the Section 333 exemptions bridge that gap with complete FAA oversight.
What is a certificate of waiver or authorization?
Okay, so a certificate of authorization or waiver or a COA is an authorization. It's issued by air traffic organization to a public operator. The key right now is public operator. You can get into civil COAs later on. Those get very, some people talk about them, some people do not. And it has to do with military surplus aircraft. And as a matter of fact, I apologize, I am not schooled on civil COAs. Kelly is.
Mm-hmm. Well,
she's our expert on that.
Hopefully in the future we'll be able to get Kelly on the show.
Absolutely. Public operator for a specific UAS activity. So there are so many regulations under Part 91 operating rules that a UAS cannot comply with. The purpose of the COA is to provide the FAA a comprehensive application process to determine whether or not to waive a particular regulation. After a complete application is submitted, the FAA conducts a comprehensive operational and technical review, very much the same as the Section 333 waiver. The difference between the COA and the Section 333 waiver is that a COA is for a public operator. An exemption is for a non-public operator.
Okay. What would be the difference between a public and a non-public operator?
A public aircraft is one that is only for the United States government or owned and operated by the government of a state, the District of Columbia, or a territory or possession of the U.S. or a political subdivision. So operators of public aircraft include Department of Defense, Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, NASA, NOAA, state and local agencies, and qualifying universities. Civil aircraft means other than a public aircraft. And there is a really great fact sheet that the FAA has on their website that you can look at. It's Unmanned Aircraft UAS General Facts, Frequently Asked Questions. So basically 14 CFR 1.1 General Definitions and Part A Subtitle 7 of Title 49 United States Code Section 40102 will dive even further into the difference between public and civil. The other thing about a public aircraft is just because you think that you're public does not mean that you're a public aircraft. You still have to provide documentation to the FAA to prove that you are a public aircraft. And usually that comes from your state attorneys general.
No, that's really good information to know about the difference of the two different types, as well as the difference between a COA and the Section 333. So now moving on. What do you see as the next step in the integration of unmanned aerial systems into American airspace?
If we set aside the small UAS rule and the 333 exemption and the COA, what we have left is airworthiness compliance. And we need to have airworthiness compliance under current regulations, which is really the technical development of UAS. The next step has to be airworthiness because it's almost the only thing that's left. There are companies who do have special airworthiness certificates, experimental. So the FAA is already moving in that direction. There's the Pathfinder program, which has been implemented for a couple of years now with different unmanned aircraft that the FAA is working to find a way forward for airworthiness. So the next step in integration of unmanned systems has to be airworthiness. We have an exemption. We have certificate of authorizations or waivers. That has to be the next step.
Okay. It's good to know. What do you see as some of the hurdles that the unmanned aerial system industry will have to overcome in the coming years as they're integrated into American airspace?
Even though I'm sitting here doing a podcast, I'd have to say the media.
The media? No, I...
You know, yeah, absolutely. As the media surges forward and latches onto the negative aspects of unmanned aircraft, society will continue to view unmanned aircraft negatively. Absolutely. When all society hears about is another drone attack in Pakistan, that's what society envisions.
Right.
So the media is going to be a huge hurdle. We have to get media on board with, you know, the feel-good stories. At the end of all the news stories, they always have that little feel-good story. So we need to start having unmanned aircraft feel-good stories. Other than the media side of the house, from a technical point of view, the Technovoid hurdle is huge. The RTCA Special Committee 228 is working diligently on developing a framework for the minimum operational performance standards for unmanned aircraft, known as MOPS. They're creating these for detect and avoid equipment and command control data links. There are private companies developing solutions to the 91-113 see and avoid hurdle. NASA has their Unmanned Aerial Traffic Management System, UTM, panel trying to develop a solution. It is one of the most difficult pieces of this puzzle to solve, and I don't think anybody has figured it out yet.
Okay.
Companies are very close to figuring this part out.
Mm-hmm.
However, what needs to happen is the companies who are on the leading edge of this technology, they need to work with RTCA, they need to work with the FAA, they need to work with other companies who are also on the cutting edge of this technology, because everybody's creating the same type of system, but it seems like a lot of companies are going in different directions with it.
What do you see the FAA doing?
The FAA requested the RTCA to come up with their MOPS. And the MOPS is how the FAA ends up with a technical standards order. The MASP and the MOPS give the framework for what a detect and avoid system needs to look like and how it needs to operate and certain technical aspects. The FAA then comes in and issues a technical standards order that says the FAA agrees with this system, and we believe that it will have to be on unmanned aircraft. The FAA will come forward and say, we believe that this technology is mandated to go onto unmanned aircraft.
I've just been signaled by my producer that we're about out of time. But before we finish our show today, or before we finish our interview with you today, I did have a couple questions that some of our listeners who knew you were going to be on our show wrote in and asked that we get these questions asked. So first, my first question is from Tony out of Atlanta, who says, who do I contact for approval to fly my RC or UAS?
Our advice there is to coordinate with your local AMA group and get together with a community-based organization. And if there isn't one in the area, contact your local Flight Standards Division office, FSDO, FISDO. Your local AMA club and or group will definitely be able to put you on the path forward, and they will tell you what you need to do in order to operate your RC aircraft, so long as it is for hobby and recreation and not for commercial.
That's key right there. I think we really need to point that part out, as long as it is for hobby and regulation, recreation and not commercial. Bethany from Indiana asks, is it better to fly first and deal with the warning cease and desist orders, or wait for the standards to come out?
UA Solutions Group would definitely say you do not fly first and deal with the warning cease and desist order at all. And our recommendation is that if the FAA calls you or sends you an email, contact them back. The other one is waiting for standards to come out. Don't wait for the standards to come out. Get an exemption. Contact somebody, contact your RC club, contact a consultant group, reach out to your local FISDO and see if they can help you with your path forward in order for you to operate in the national airspace instead of waiting for the small rule to come out in 2 years.
All right. That's excellent advice. I apologize to all of the people who wrote in tonight if we did not have a chance to get to your questions. They're good questions, and I promise we are going to have Christina back on the show with us, hopefully with her business partner, and we will get those questions asked. Christina, I'd like to thank you once again for being on our show today. It has been an absolute pleasure. Please come back and join us again.
Absolutely. I had a great time. I want to thank Mike here and his team at UAS today again. This was awesome. Thanks.
Thank you.
My interview with Christina Ng was recorded earlier this month, and I hope you've enjoyed listening. We're about out of time today, but before we end this podcast, I'd like to end with a closing remark. We are a society driven by technology. We use it every day for entertainment, communication, transportation, and medical purposes. Yet the question still remains, how can a society driven by technology be afraid of new technology that promises jobs, innovations, and making our lives easier? The answer is simple. Any technology, new or old, in the wrong hands can be used for bad things. But that still does not mean we should be quick to shut it out. Now, in this podcast, we discussed FAA regulations and the difficulties that new and existing companies are facing in America while we wait for rules and regulations to be established. However, unlike the threat of new technology in the wrong hands, and unlike the waiting game that companies are currently facing, there is another concern that we must be mindful of, and that is the potential for American-based companies to fail before they even get started. As I've said before, companies that are currently using this technology will have a discernible advantage over new companies that are starting after the FAA allows businesses to use unmanned aerial systems for commercial purposes. If American companies are forced to wait on the FAA, then we will see a rapidly growing trend of manufacturing jobs being sent to other countries and foreign-owned companies flying unmanned aerial systems in American airspace. While we have good reason to fear the use of unmanned aerial systems in American airspace, we must ask ourselves if preventing their use now will hurt our job market later. For UAS Today, I'm Michael Garrity.
The views and opinions expressed on our podcast are those of the authors, producers, and our guests. They do not automatically reflect the views or opinions of any organization or government agency that are guests on our podcast, nor do they reflect the official policy or position of any U.S. government agency. If you have information that you would like to have discussed on our show or would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us on our website, uas-today.com, or email us at podcast@uas-today.com. Thanks for listening.